Welcome to the World Vision Report. Election fever is running high in Liberia. The first woman president in Africa wants another shot at the job. We'll hear what Liberians think of that. A decorated Iraq war veteran launches a new battle, but this time on poverty.
You know, I walk to work every day, and they think I'm crazy. You know, like the first month I was here, they thought I was nuts. You know, what's a white guy doing walking out in the bush, you know?
And in India, home cooking turns into fast food. That's thanks to the Dabbawalas. They're the lunchbox men of Mumbai, and they don't let anything get in the way of their deliveries.
He's going the wrong way down the street, but since he's a Dabbawala, no policeman would stop him.
Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Peggy Waymeyer. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. The two bombs found on cargo planes headed to the U.S. last week are stark reminders of the ongoing war on terror. It's a war Jake Harriman knows all too well. He was a special ops Marine in Iraq. But a chilling experience there changed him forever. Now, Jake Harriman's on a mission to end terrorism by fighting poverty. Kelsey Timmerman reports.
You know, I walk to work every day, and they think I'm crazy. You know, like the first month I was here, they thought I was nuts. You know, what's a white guy doing walking out in the bush, you know?
The white guy is Jake Harriman. His 6'3" are topped with a blonde mop of bedhead. They are the residents of the Korea district, one of Kenya's most impoverished.
What is a tin shed over there?
A tin shed is actually a shed that where we hide our cocaine.
Jake has a pretty good sense of humor. I'm not sure I would be capable of laughing, having seen what Jake has seen. More on that in a bit.
Is it ready?
Jake elaborates on the cocaine shed.
That's our, it's actually more than a shed, it's a granary. So, in our first season here of the granary, it's been a great success. We've got about 250 or 240 tons of maize sitting in the granary right now, of all surplus maize.
Jake, a former Marine, founded and runs an organization called Nuru International. Nuru means light in Swahili. The granary is the hub of Nuru's activities in Korea. It's where daily meetings take place and where farmers bring their harvest. Josephat is one of the farmers. He's a wiry man who waits on the side of the road as we approach. He's dwarfed by a wall of bright green corn behind him. Josephat explains how his field and life have changed in only a few short seasons.
I was almost ready to give up. I was working a lot in the field. 2 acres were producing only 6 bags of corn. It wasn't enough. Now, after Nuru, I plant 1 acre and harvest 30 bags.
Josephat's wife pours corn into a tin bucket. His success began with a loan from Nuru in the form of high-quality seeds and fertilizers.
Now I visit farmers and tell them about myself, where I was and where I am right now. And I'm trying to change their lives, like mine was changed.
To understand the change in Josephat's life, you'd have to understand the change that happened to Jake in Iraq. He was awarded the Bronze Star for actions taken in combat during his second tour there. But it was an event during his first tour, back in 2003, that stands out the most. As Jake talks, he lifts his imaginary rifle and points it at an imaginary oncoming white car. He yells, "Get down!" at an imaginary man he thinks is a suicide bomber who has stepped out of the car and is running at him.
I'm raising up my rifle to kind of sight in on him, and I look behind him, though, and I see, that's when I see this large black military truck rolling up right behind his white car. And that's when I realized what was going on.
That black truck belonged to Saddam's special forces, the Fedayeen. They were going from village to village, forcibly recruiting men to pick up AK-47s and strap bombs to themselves to fight the American forces. The men were promised that their families would be taken care of if they were killed.
So we were fighting hundreds and thousands of these guys. Guys who never even seen a weapon before were running at us.
The man running at Jake was trying to escape with his family before he could be recruited. But before Jake and the soldiers under his command realized this, the Fedayeen shot up the man's car.
My guys and I, you know, they trained in on those. The Fedayeen took those guys out, but it was too late. You know, by the time I got there, looked in the car in the passenger seat. His wife was there, and you know, she had been shot in the face and in the head and the chest, and she was dead.
And so were the man's children.
And I said,
What would I have done if I was in this guy's shoes? You know, southern Iraq, especially during the invasion, is extremely impoverished. You know, farmers with on this arid land couldn't produce enough food for their families. And this guy is a guy who had no choices in life. And something changed in me that day.
Jake began to believe that he could have a bigger impact on the war on terror by fighting extreme poverty. He left the Marines in 2005 and got his MBA in social entrepreneurism at Stanford. That's where Nuru was born. Jake founded Nuru with money from everyone from classmates to Silicon Valley entrepreneurs. He wanted to launch his pilot program in a place that needed help with a whole lot of things. Agriculture, water, sanitation, healthcare, education, and economic development. Those are the areas of Nuru's focus. Kenya's Korea district fit the bill. Here's how Nuru works. Think of it as a general contractor building a home. And Jake is that guy from Extreme Makeover Home Edition. If the show needs plumbing work, they bring in the best plumber. They know they need electrical work, so they bring in the best electrician. And when Nuru needs to increase crop yields...
We don't waste time trying to reinvent the wheel. Instead, we found a really amazing model for agriculture called One Acre Fund.
The One Acre Fund helps farmers in East Africa increase their efficiency and purchasing power. Nuru is also helping to support a community banking program here, as well as a program that provides safe drinking water. Jake says, a year and a half into the project, Nuru has touched the lives of some 5,000 people. Jake is a Bronze Star-wearing hero, but he says the villagers of the Korea district are his heroes.
These are brave individuals. I mean, these guys are braver, more intelligent, more resourceful, more driven than I'll ever be. They survive things that, like... You know, me and all my spec ops training could never have survived. They're incredible people.
How's it? Welcome. Good.
Yes. Are you in the Rafiki Hango? Anaitwa Kelsey.
Our walk ends at the granary. Jake introduces me to a group of farmers standing in a circle. He has worked alongside them sowing seed and turning land. The Nuru compound where Jake and his staff live sits a few fields above a stream where village chatter gives way to buzzing insects. This is the closest thing he has to a home in Kenya or in the United States. It's a concrete building that has a summer camp feel to it. In moments of relaxation, Jake will briefly mention the lifestyle he's foregoing. The one with nieces and nephews, dating, and a family of his own. But he'd rather focus on the future of Nuru than his own future plans.
We want to rip away the potential of powder, quote-unquote powder keg nations from blowing up. And essentially doing what we should have done in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if that had happened, none of that stuff that I would have saw, had seen, you know, take place would have actually been taking place, because those folks that were in absolute desperation would have had choices. They would have had other opportunities to feed their kids rather than pick up that AK-47.
Now that Nuru has been successful with its pilot project in Kenya, Jake hopes to move it into countries with ongoing conflicts, places like Afghanistan, Somalia, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And that's when Jake's theory, that the best way to fight terrorism and instability is to fight extreme poverty, will really be put to the test. For the World Vision Report, I'm Kelsey Timmerman in Korea, Kenya.
Cell phones in the developing world are used for just about everything, for transferring money, checking crop prices at the market, and even for reminding people to take their HIV medications. In past shows, we've brought you stories about all of these. Now it looks as if cell phones have even more tricks up their sleeves. The World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber checked out some new developments and brings us this report.
Remember when the most exciting features of our cell phones were the different ringtones?
And I am sick and tired of my phone, baby.
Yeah, ancient history. Today it's all about how many megapixels our camera has, whether the phone's GPS can direct us to our destination, which app is the best to choose a restaurant for us, maybe even someday magically transport us there. In short, these phones are really tiny computers.
We have in our pockets access to a very sophisticated hardware and software.
That's Aidegon Oshan. He's an assistant professor in electrical engineering at UCLA.
So that could really be leveraged to bring new microscopes that does not exist today.
Yes, microscopes. See, basic microscope technology has barely changed in the past few centuries. There's a lens, and it magnifies what's on the slide, like in high school biology. It's bulky, but it's crucial for peering at cells and diagnosing diseases such as malaria. So, thought Oshan, any way the cell phone could help, particularly in poor countries and distant villages? And he came up with this idea: capture the cell's shadow.
The shadow knows.
Because unlike our own shadows, which are pitch dark, the cell's shadows are textured.
That's because light passes through some parts of cells and not through others. So the image looks lighter and darker in places, with fringes along the edges. Here's how a cell phone microscope would work. A small device is clipped over your cell phone, and there's a place for, say, a blood sample. A tiny light on the clip shines through the sample. Then the cell's camera captures the image of the shadow.
But essentially what you would be seeing on the cell phone screen would be some artistic images of the shadows of the cells, which are fairly difficult to interpret with the bare eye.
So a photo of the cell's shadow is sent to a computer at a local hospital. Ocean's team has designed computer programs that can recognize each cell's particular shadow, like a cellular fingerprint. It can recognize, for instance, a red blood cell or a white blood cell, or a malaria parasite. A tool such as this could be crucial in the fight against malaria. Accurate diagnosis could prevent overuse of drugs, which is expensive and can lead to drug resistance. Okay, that's the first cool new cell phone and health development that just came out this year, a cell phone-based microscope. Next week, I'll be back with another. For the World Vision Report, I'm Cynthia Graber.
If you're trying to figure out what a cell phone microscope looks like, you can see a photo on our website, worldvisionreport.org. It's election season, and not just here in the U.S. Africa is humming with election activity, too. Sometimes elections there are hampered by corruption or outbreaks of violence. But when they run smoothly, Africans count on their elections to bring the kind of change that can help lift them out of poverty. So far, this election season has been peaceful. In Tanzania, votes are still being counted. And in the next few weeks, Guinea will hold its first election in 50 years. Farther south in Liberia, the first woman president in Africa is running for re-election. We'll take you there to hear how that's shaping up. That's next on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. 5 years ago, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was elected president of Liberia. She was the first woman president in all of Africa. Sirleaf inherited a country shattered by 14 years of civil war. A quarter of a million people died in that war, and it destroyed Liberia's economy and infrastructure. But Sirleaf has won international acclaim for the progress she's made as president. So it's no surprise that the 72-year-old leader says she's running for a second term. But her election isn't guaranteed. Here's Bonnie Allen.
As the sun rises over Monrovia, Liberia's capital city, Agata Pay scrambles to get her seven children out the door and off to school. But there's no breakfast for any of them.
They don't eat in the morning.
They don't eat in the morning. They only eat one time a day. Sometimes we eat at night.
Pei wakes up at 4:30 every morning to bake bread, and her kids carry it to school with them. But it's not for them to eat. It's for them to sell to other students.
They have to go around to sell.
They have to go around to sell, just for us to be able to survive.
Despite the struggle, Pei says her life has improved in the past 5 years.
The difference in my life is...
The difference in my life is right now, there is peace. There are no rockets falling on houses or houses burning.
Pei credits Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf for the change. Pei supported Sirleaf the first time she ran for office in 2005 and says she'll vote for her again next year.
I call her Ma Ellen because she is mother to this nation.
But as Pei walks to work, crossing a narrow wooden bridge surrounded by swamp and rice fields, she admits she'd hoped for more.
When Ellen came into power, the first thing she promised us were jobs, the second, education, third, electricity, and fourth, running water.
She says Sirleaf's government has fallen short on all of these promises. Pei works here at a private school on a small island in the marshy outskirts of Monrovia. One of the first things President Sirleaf did after taking office was introduce free and compulsory primary education. Enrollment jumped drastically. But almost 5 years later, Liberia still doesn't have enough public schools or trained teachers. And one of the places without a government school is here on Pegasus Island. The closest one is an hour's walk away, so children still pay to attend classes. This morning there must be 300 children crammed into just a few classrooms. I can see that there aren't enough desks and many of the students are standing. And outside there is a long line of parents, each one clutching a plastic bag of money. They're waiting reluctantly to pay school fees.
As parents come, they got something at $200, $300.
It's Pei's job to collect the money, and today is the deadline. Any child who doesn't pay is being kicked out of school.
I can't beg. So you yell, you won't have to beg.
I've come to beg, says Helena Wante. The grandmother has five children in this school and owes the equivalent of $100 for their tuition, a small fortune here. After much haggling, she takes two of her grandchildren home.
Our children, everybody are fighting hard to go to school.
Our children, everybody is fighting hard to go to school. No money. We're selling whatever we can, trying to fight for the children to go to school.
In the Pegasus Island school, children sing the alphabet in a dark classroom. The school's small windows don't let in much light, and there's no electricity here. In fact, there's no electricity in most of Liberia, despite Sirleaf's early promise to quickly rebuild the country's electricity system. Sirleaf insists her administration is working as fast as possible to rebuild the country. Still, in her presidential office, cloaked in a green gown and headdress, the tough-talking woman is blunt about people's expectations, just 7 years out of war.
They may think it's instantaneous, that once you put the support there, there's this quick fix, there's this great transformation. It takes time for it, but I do believe progress has been made.
While high expectations have led to disappointment at home, on the international stage, Sirleaf is a bit of a superstar. She's a Harvard-educated economist, and recently she was named one of the top 10 leaders in the world by Newsweek magazine. Moreover, she's wiped out all of Liberia's debt. That's more than $5 billion. And on top of that, she's convinced foreign companies that Liberia is a safe place to do business. Now they're eagerly moving in to capitalize on the country's rich minerals and forests, bringing promises of jobs with them. But Sirleaf promised jobs 5 years ago, and the delay has caused frustration among Liberians, especially ex-combatants and disgruntled young men. Sirleaf knows that.
They were child soldiers. They don't have any skills, so getting them employed is a difficult task.
Sirleaf may have trouble convincing voters to keep her in office to do this work if she cannot crack down on another rampant problem in Liberia, corruption. She's introduced several anti-corruption measures, but the police and the courts, she says, haven't followed through by arresting and prosecuting people for corruption.
The reason people say that's not enough is being done is the fact that they don't see punishment. They don't see people going to jail. We've had one corruption case in the courts for 3 years. 3 years.
Still, Sirleaf's failure to rein in corrupt officials has left many voters frustrated, including the principal at the Pegasus Island School, Pastor Aaron Grimes.
The government does not have the political will to prosecute people that are corrupting the nation. Before Sirleaf could come to power, she was a champion in that area, but only to come to power, we found out that she's not living up to that tax. I personally, I would not be in a position to vote for this person president.
She's doing her best.
The women of Liberia seem to be more forgiving and comprise much of Sirleaf's electoral support. After the school day is over, Agatape sits down with a small group of women on the island. They all say that Sirleaf has inspired them and given them hope. One woman says, "We no longer see guns firing, so it makes me happy." As Pei walks home, she describes how during the 14-year civil war, she was too scared to sleep in a bed.
At night, you don't lie down on the bed because you are afraid that when they fire guns, the gunshot will hit you. So we would lie down on the ground. But now, I feel free to sleep on the bed.
For her, that's enough for now. For the World Vision Report, I'm Bonnie Allen in Monrovia, Liberia.
Rwanda's another country that was racked by war and by genocide, but it's made a remarkable recovery. We go there now with our global guru.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. This week we ask one simple question, just one, from somewhere in the world. Today we're in Rwanda asking, how'd everything get so clean?
Umuganda would be one of the pillars, the social traditional practices that should be used as a way to bring back unity.
This is Charles Kayatana, a professor in Kigali. He's telling me about Umuganda, a kind of traditional Rwandan volunteerism, where a community gets together and they
build up a public building like a primary school or a bridge where a road has broken down.
Sometimes they plant trees or build houses for the needy or clean up trash. Kayatana calls it
a future and a way forward for the Rwandan society to be revived.
It works like this. On the last Saturday of every month, all Rwandans pitch in a few hours of free labor. Businesses close, bus service stops, and even the president pitches in. Afterwards, they hold meetings to discuss current issues or make community announcements.
And everybody seems to be appreciating it because it is an obligation.
Umuganda dates back to pre-colonial times. Originally, it enabled small villages to get together and help those in need. But after the 1994 genocide, Umuganda became a balm for the shattered country. Today, Rwanda has the unlikely honor of being about the cleanest developing country on the planet. But more importantly, says Kayatana, it's reconciling a fractured people.
When people meet and they discuss issues that concern all of them, because if you say, for example, you're repairing a road is for everybody to use. If it is a bridge that makes people cross from one end to the other, it's still beneficial to everybody.
For Kayatana, Umuganda is partly about community and partly about something much more personal, something he can't quite name.
Do you feel that you have rendered a good service to humanity?
It's like the feeling he has when he sees five trees he planted years ago.
I've grown up and I know these are my trees. Each time I pass there, I look at them, I feel happy.
The Global Guru is produced in association with American University's College of Arts and Sciences and WAMU 88.5 in Washington, D.C. Original theme by the Plush Interiors. To submit ideas, email globalguru@american.edu. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Thanks for listening.
Our Global Guru just explained how Umuganda helped unify Rwandans after the genocide there. Other countries have used more formal proceedings to bring peace. Probably the most famous of these is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. There are all kinds of ways African countries have tried to heal the damage left in the wake of war. John Hirsch was U.S. ambassador to Sierra Leone from 1995 to 1998. While he was there, he witnessed conflicts across the African continent. He also watched attempts at reconciliation. Now he joins us from New York City. John Hirsch, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
Not all countries who are coming out of conflicts foster reconciliation through official commissions like South Africa's.
Right.
How else have you seen it happen?
Well, the most interesting experience that I would mention to you was my visit to Mozambique which, as you know, is right next door to South Africa, and where there had been a 26-year war. And when that war came to an end, with the help of the United Nations, they entered into a peace agreement. Part of the peace agreement was an amnesty. So there was no Truth and Reconciliation Commission established. This was preceded the TRC in South Africa. And there were also no trials, such as would happen later on in Rwanda. And when I visited Mozambique in 2007, I had been at a conference in Cape Town on this topic. I interviewed a really pretty wide swath of people, and I found essentially that everybody had made a decision back then in 93, 94 to move ahead and to focus on building up the country again rather than on pursuing perpetrators of these violent acts. But secondly, the churches played a big role in this, and I met one of the bishops there who had been involved, and one of the stories he told me was how a number of the artists had collected these weapons and they had fabricated a tree of life out of stock of these weapons, the rifles and so on, and which was then presented as an artistic way to memorialize the conflict and sort of have a kind of a different way of looking at all of this, rather, again, than having a judicial process. And I think it worked also because it was not a high-profile thing. It wasn't in the front page of the New York Times every day. So people didn't get up to say, is this okay or not okay?
And John, you mentioned that that kind of attitude is very different than what we have here in the United States, where justice is really important in order to move forward, legal justice. How would you explain the way of thinking or living that allows these people to not need legal justice or revenge, but to really forgive and move forward, maybe even living in the same community with your enemy?
Well, I think people live much closer to the edge in their economic situation, so that survival, having enough to eat, having some clothing, having some shelter, you know, becomes very important. I'll try to give you the example of Sierra Leone, where I was, as you know, the ambassador for 3 years. And while I was there, and shortly thereafter, there was also the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was set up there. And there, there had been these dreadful atrocities where people's limbs, even children, little boys and girls had had their legs or arms amputated. It was very violent. But I found that what most people wanted was a chance to have a better life for themselves and their children. So what did that translate into? Well, they wanted, where there'd been these dreadful events, to have prostheses and be able to regain their ability to function. And some of that has happened. They wanted some economic activity, jobs. They wanted peace and quiet. They wanted to get along with their lives. I think, again, here, both the churches and the mosques have played a role. At the time of the negotiations that brought about finally the end of the conflict, there was an interreligious forum which met and kind of pushed the parties to come to an agreement. So you had a general willingness to go on with their lives. So all this business about putting people behind bars, while some of the international community has felt that was important, I don't want to totally negate it, but I don't think that it had the same resonance for the Sierra Leonean population at large that it's had for the international human rights community.
Let's talk about some of the challenges. I mean, obviously, the reconciliation process is different in each country. You've already mentioned Mozambique and Sierra Leone and South Africa. Are there some universal challenges to bringing about reconciliation after brutal civil wars and ethnic rivalries?
There's a big challenge of how to have attitudes sort of evolve so that you move on rather than sort of just nursing these disputes. And I think Rwanda is still kind of fraught with tension because people kind of worry whether there might be some kind of recurrence down the line. Again, I think local leaders are tremendously important. And then, to the extent that people can see a better future for themselves, I think that becomes the vital point here. If you can kind of think that your kids are going to have a better chance, then you've got a chance to move ahead.
you know, forgiving a whole group of people or even one person who's caused you or your family great harm is a very difficult thing to do. And it's especially difficult, it seems, when the perpetrator doesn't admit their guilt. How critical in the reconciliation processes you've seen is it for the victims to get apologies and admissions of guilt from those who are responsible for inflicting the pain?
Well, I think it is important, and it doesn't always happen. In the case of South Africa, as I already said to you, people were able to come forward and tell their stories, the victims. And some people acknowledged responsibility, but not a lot of people. But the commission as a whole sort of acknowledged or took on the responsibility of the former government and of the police. So there was some kind of public recognition. In Rwanda, you've had these gachacha processes where there are local community tribunals and people supposed to come forward and acknowledge their crimes. And in some cases, they have. So, yes, I think it is important to have some acknowledgement, either directly by the perpetrators or by the TRC as a commission head.
And the hope, obviously, is that it will put an end or greatly slow down the ethnic and tribal rivalries rather than tear these countries apart. Do you think the reconciliation efforts that we've spoken of here have real staying power?
I do. I think in the countries we're talking about, definitely. I mean, I think South Africa has certainly moved beyond those situations. I find it, you know, inconceivable that there'll be another kind of conflict of the, you know, the ethnic conflict. That doesn't mean there won't be crime. I think Sierra Leone and Liberia have moved beyond conflict. Again, there may be local crime because of unemployment, but that's different. I think they've gone beyond these kind of ethnic conflicts.
John Hirsch is former U.S. ambassador to Sierra Leone. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Peggy, thank you for the chance to share my thoughts with you and your audience.
Coming up, fast food, Mumbai style. That's next on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. I'm Peggy Waymeyer, and you're listening to the World Vision Report. Fast food has a bad reputation in this country. It's often blamed for the epidemic of obesity here. But in Mumbai, India, fast food means something entirely different. It's not the mass-produced fatty stuff we think of. Fast food in Mumbai is cooked fresh at home. Then it's rushed to offices and workplaces across town in little aluminum lunchboxes that they call tiffins. They're delivered by the lunchbox men, and they're known in Mumbai as the Dabbawalas. They're poor and mostly illiterate. But Dabbawalas run the lunch delivery service with remarkable efficiency. Reporter Peter Aronson follows the journey of one particular lunch.
Sunita Shuram Kesarkar puts the finishing touches on her husband's lunch, a vegetarian meal which consists of
varan, bhat, chapati, bhaji.
Rice, dal, chapati, and vegetables, she says. She carefully packs each course into a metal bowl that stacks together and fits in a traditional Indian lunchbox called a tiffin. Her husband left for work across town hours ago, but she'll send his lunch with a dabbawala, or lunchbox man, who'll be here any minute. There are 5,000 of them in Mumbai, each carrying dozens of metal lunchboxes at a time.
This dabbawala person is very important for our family because if the dabbawala tiffin man was not there, I would wake up at 5 a.m. and prepare the tiffin because my husband leaves at 7 in the morning. But the service is available, so that's why I can start at 10 o'clock.
Why not just buy something for lunch? Well, nearly all Indians prefer home cooking, but there's another reason why dabbawalas are so important in this city. Mumbai residents commute to work on severely overcrowded trains. They're so packed, they don't really even have room for lunchboxes.
You'll have a taste of our house.
Of course, a reporter can't visit their home without being offered some food.
It's very good.
The family's dabbawala finally arrives. But Sunil Sabajaruti is nearly an hour late. The 24-year-old has been a dabbawala for 8 years. I dash out with him.
Okay, bye.
He hangs the lunchbox on his bicycle along with about 24 others and pedals off for his next stop. He's carrying what's known as a Gandhi hat, a cap that resembles what burger flippers wear in the U.S.
Sunil has put on his white Gandhi hat, which is kind of his right-of-way sign. He's going the wrong way down the street. But since he's a Dabbawala, no policeman would stop him.
Dabbawalas are free to do whatever's necessary to get those lunches delivered on time. After collecting all the lunches on his route, he races to the nearest train station.
Hello.
Here the lunchboxes are sorted at a furious pace. They'll typically change hands at least 3 times before being delivered to their final destination. Usually, Mr. Kesarkar's lunch travels by train, but maybe because the first Dabbawala was late, this time it'll travel by bicycle relay. All lunches must arrive by 1 o'clock. The Dabbawala's system is a model of efficiency. It moves 200,000 lunches each day across a 37-mile radius of Mumbai, and they do all that in just 3 hours, without the aid of computers or barcodes. Actually, most Dabbawalas can't read, so they use a simplified system of markings painted on each lunchbox to indicate the route it should travel and its final destination. Their process earned a coveted international certification for reliability known as Six Sigma, which means they only make one mistake in every 16 million transactions. Manish Tripathi is the honorary director of the Mumbai Dabbawalas. He says one of the things that accounts for their success is their core philosophy, which reflects both their Hindu upbringing and their work ethic.
Now, every Dabbawala has certain beliefs which guides him, wherever he is working. So these beliefs are work is worship, serving people is serving God, delivering food is the best service to the humanity, time is money, and unity is power.
Tripathi says Dabbawalas scrape by a meager living on their 100-and-some-dollar a month average salary.
They don't have good houses. They don't have access to the medical facilities. The good news is that some of the Dabbawalas who are working very hard, their kids have got higher education, and now the status of their family is getting better and better.
Back out on the street, the lunch Mrs. Kesarkar packed this morning is just moments away from its final destination.
My name is Shivram Pandurang Kesarkar. I'm a florist man since last 30 years.
At his flower shop in Mumbai's Kulaba neighborhood, Mr. Kesarkar is waiting for the Dabbawala to deliver his lunchbox, or tiffin, just as he's been doing for more than a quarter century.
And no mistake, that is true. He's not giving your tiffin to me, my tiffin to another fellow. He's not. No mistake like that.
Finally, a Dabbawala hands Kesarkar his lunch, still warm and fresh, and quickly dashes back out again without a word.
So you have
dal rice.
Dal and rice.
Chapatis.
Chapatis.
And
some kind of vegetables. You have vegetables.
Vegetables.
Enjoy your lunch.
Yes, yes.
Thank you so much, sir. And that's it. He's off to deliver his next dabba.
He'll be back in a little while, though, to pick up the empty lunchbox, which will make the same trip in reverse later this afternoon. For the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson in Mumbai, India.
Prachi Pingli knows all about Dabbawalas. She sees them every day, delivering delicious hot lunches around town. Prachi reports from Mumbai for the BBC, and she joins us now with more about the Dabbawalas. Hi, Prachi. Thanks for joining us.
Hi.
Now, we heard in this piece that the practice of delivering these lunches has been going on for more than 100 years. Do you have any idea how it got started?
This is a story which has been told to me by other Dabbawalas, that over 100 years back, a person wanted his tiffin to be delivered from his home to his office. And that is how it all started. I think in about 1890 or so, the guy who used to carry his tiffin then kind of developed the service for other people, and it started with about 100 people, and now it's 5,000 strong force, which is serving the people of Mumbai to have their hot lunches.
Can anyone be a Dabbawala, or is there some kind of passing of the torch involved?
anyone can be a Dabbawala, but actually speaking, the community comes from a certain area in the state. So the Dabbawala community mostly has been preferring to hand over their job from generations, like hand it down to their children. There have been a few people coming from outside, but very few. Mostly they come from one particular community.
And they're mostly illiterate and pretty poor.
Oh, yes, totally. I mean, most of them have not had any education in English. So they're not able to access computers or read in English or any such thing. But the way they code their tiffins in different colors and numbers are so precise that their precision is 99.99%. I mean, they're like really perfect on the way they work. Their supply chain management has been studied by several universities from abroad, and it is a matter of great pride for them.
Right now, their whole process of organizing and setting up these deliveries is done by color coding. Can you describe that a little in more detail?
It's basically, you know, they have these numbers for the area from where it's coming and the number for the area that it's going. And you'll see yellow, green, red marks on the aluminium tiffin, which contains all the food that there is. And then at different stations, they kind of exchange the tiffins so that the person who is, say, going to point A in South Mumbai takes all the red marked tiffins, and person who goes to point B takes all the green marked. But they don't come from the same suburbs, right? Like, they're collected from all over Mumbai, and then they have to be assembled and reassembled at some common point, and they're at it nonstop.
Peter Aronson, in his piece, brought out the point that it's the Dabbawala's personal beliefs, their religious beliefs, that really guide them in their work. They think that serving people is serving God, and that delivering food is actually the best service you can give to humanity. Did you find these beliefs really driving how they do their work?
Yeah, but we're so passionate about what they do. Like, I think the most important thing that about them is dedication. I mean, they don't drink, they don't indulge in any lavish stuff. I mean, you know, they live a very, very simple life, and they feel that they're born to do this, so they want to do a very, very good job of it. In fact, they started this, there is an open university. So after having a meeting with the Dabbawalas, this university has designed a spoken English and basic computer skills course. So they work from Monday to Saturday, and then they have Sunday classes.
Are they studying so they can be even better at their jobs?
Yes. It's like you ask them about, you know, why do you want to learn English? Then one of them told me, and he was like pretty old, like he's like one of the senior most members of the community. And he was like, you know, I want to learn English because I want to read the text message that I get, because many of the customers nowadays send them their addresses via text messages, and they're not able to read it. So he was like, you know, I want to learn how to work on a mobile and read the text message. So, you know, like, at that age, you're working that kind of hours, and you still want, and you still have all the curiosity to get better at this.
So I'm curious, Prachi, you're a businesswoman in Mumbai. Have you ever ordered lunch from a Dabbawala?
No, that's because you need somebody cooking for you at home.
Oh, so you have to have your mother or a friend or somebody cooking in order for them to pick up your lunch.
Yeah.
So how do you get your lunch?
I am a correspondent, and I'm probably on the go all the time. So I pick up my lunch from anywhere and everywhere, unfortunately.
And what do the Dabbawalas do for their lunches?
They don't really rest for anything, because they have to deliver the lunch before lunchtime, and they have to start collecting them back so that it's delivered back to the suburban homes by evening so that it's ready for the next day. So their lunch is on the go.
Prachi Pingli reports for the BBC and lives in Mumbai, India. Prachi, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Peggy.
More home-cooked food now, this time from Argentina. Marcos Fetterman introduces us to a baker called Delia.
Delia Vinci carries 20 pounds of homemade bread in a big reed basket as she calls out her wares. The 23-year-old has been selling bread at this port for 3 years now. She learned to bake on a hitchhiking trip to Brazil.
I learned by helping a Brazilian at his bakery. He gave me some strength to realize it is possible to work as a baker and earn some money. He also taught me how to deal with customers and how to be a good seller.
¿Cuánto sale este pan?
Tiene dulce,
And it seems that Brazilian baker taught her well because she has a number of faithful customers.
Está bien hecho, ¿eh? Muy lindo.
Y este 6 pesos que es el dulce.
Ah, bueno.
Gracias, ¿eh?
Delia bakes various types of bread. Some contain nuts and apple pieces, some have raisins and plums, others sunflower and sesame seeds. But she's not at this port every day. That's because she must take a full day to bake.
Está bien. Claro, hago día por medio porque un día...
I come to the port every 2 days because I need to stay at home to work. Preparing the dough, cutting the apples, shaping the bread and baking it. It takes a lot of will.
Her customers appreciate Delia's effort to keep her bread healthy and inexpensive. She charges less than a dollar for a 2-pound loaf. But Delia pays a price for keeping her prices low.
Pero por ahora, como con lo de la panadería,
baking is working for me now, though I don't earn much money, just barely enough to eat and pay my rent.
After a long day, Delia sells some bread to a woman that was running to catch her boat to go back home. I always buy bread from her, the woman says, because it's good, healthy, and cheap. But it's not been a good day for Delia. She hasn't sold a lot of bread, and to make matters worse, there was a bad storm last night. Delia lives alone on a tiny island with just 10 other houses, all flooded by last night's storm. She needs to clean up the mess tonight so she can bake tomorrow and sell on the next day. At dusk, Delia is ready to go home. She usually gives away her last loaf of bread, but this time there are several pounds left after a difficult day. She says she is glad for my company and decides to give me a big loaf of bread with nuts and apple pieces that I find delicious. For the World Vision Report, I'm Marcos Federman in Buenos Aires, Argentina.
Secopi, el Centro de Educación y Comunicación para Comunidades.
That's what aid worker William Powers heard when he turned on the radio in El Alto, Bolivia.
Tu hija igual de coqueta que vos. Toma mierda, carajo, toma.
It's a soap opera produced by local young people and based on their lives. The radio dramas are popular, and the stories they tell are helping bring down rates of HIV in teen pregnancy.
They gang-raped me. A 17-year-old girl named Raimunda told me across a hardwood table. A silence suddenly entombed the chilly room. El Alto, a sprawling city of 1 million, is perched at a frigid and breathless 13,000 feet above sea level. Some of the discotheques here have rooms with tanks for oxygen breaks. I looked back at Raimunda. Long, thick hair spilled over her dark complexion. Noticing the awkwardness in the room, she clarified, "I mean they gang-raped Jessica." I let out a sigh of relief. Jessica is a character, the one Raimunda plays on Looking for Love, an increasingly popular radio soap opera focusing on HIV/AIDS and sexual and reproductive health. This innovative radio novella, with support from the nonprofit aid group PCI Media Impact, airs on Radio Altipiri, a unique radio station run by the indigenous Aymara people. Raimunda spoke of her character's grim fate. Jessica came from a middle-class El Alto family, but her parents were so busy with work that they didn't make enough time for her. In rebellion, looking for love, you might say, Jessica frequented dodgy bars after school, ones that unethically cater to teens. In the play, she met two guys one day in one of these bars. They seemed nice, but they took her to the woods and raped and killed her. After talking about her character, Raimunda was choked up. I served as an aid worker in Bolivia for several years, and I know the border between fiction and reality here is slippery. Is Raimunda's life really much different from Jessica's? Bosco Katari is a cherubic 33-year-old who helped a group of teenagers write Looking for Love. He said, "We pluck stories out of the fabric of El Alto life." Jessica was indeed based on an actual person. Raimunda went on, "Their daughter had to die for her parents to realize they should have simply talked with her. By then it was too late." But then came the upshot. Raimunda had been like Jessica. Her parents had been too busy. She had been looking for love in the wrong places. But then Raimunda listened to Jessica's story with her parents. "Because of the radio program," she said, "my parents started talking to me, and they listened. Jessica changed our family. Small transformations like this one, multiplied by thousands, is how radio storytelling is reducing HIV rates, delaying teen pregnancy, and getting more people treated in clinics in Bolivia. It works because these issues are displaced to the third person, where they can still be felt emotionally, but with enough distance to make them safe to discuss. Young people not only write, but also act in and host the programs, using their teen spirit to positively influence their listener peers. Without Radio Altipiri, would Raimunda have ended up dead, like Jessica? It's impossible to say, but that afternoon, as the sun set brilliantly, a glowing red so hot that it seemed to warm even frigid El Alto, I saw in Raimunda's smile that Radio Altipiri had given her fresh confidence and hope.
Ay, qué pena. Oye, se nota que le quieres mucho a tu mamá, ¿no?
No sabe, Jessica.
That's an aid worker diary from William Powers. Powers' latest book is 12 by 12, a one-room cabin off the grid and beyond the American dream. And that story of the power of radio is where we end our radio show this week. If you have something you'd like to hear, a story, an interview, or even a musician from the developing world, we'd love to know. Visit our website at worldvisionreport.org and give us your comments and story ideas. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.